Hello and welcome to the podcast. This is Ron's Amazing Stories. Happy Thanksgiving to all of you, and thank you for taking the time to listen to the show. This week, we have an amazing show. For the past several months, we've been playing the novel Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. It has been read for us by Mark Nelson. On today's show, we will hear chapters 20 through 22, and this will lead us to next week's epic conclusion. Also, Mark will be with us live to play those final minutes of the book. How about that? Also, on today's show, I will reveal the story sent in by you that is a personal favorite. How? Let me tell you, picking a favorite was difficult. In the end, it became more of a dart throw. What you'll hear is a segment from episode number 334, Mason Henry Blue. So, let's get to the show and let me tell you a story. This first story comes from Mason Henry Blue. First, let me say that I didn't believe the name either until I had the pleasure to talk to Mason on the telephone. He is about as real and down-home country as a man can get. He declined to come on the program but wanted to tell us a story. Mason said he heard the podcast we had some time ago with author Alan Day. He loved Alan's interview so much that he wanted to tell one of his stories to match. You can listen to that interview with Alan Day on episode number 166, The Horse Lover. But for now, here is Mason's story as he told it to me. My name is Mason Henry Blue. My friends call me Buckles. I got the name during my rodeo years. I earned a few of them a time or two. My story comes from the late 1940s. I was a young man, just about 18 years old. My folks had just given me the get out or take over the farm speech. I chose to get out. I began working at a place near Dallas called the South Fork Ranch. My job in those early years was to clean the bunkhouse, wash clothes, and help the cook. Later, I became the handyman and protector. There were two predators there that had to be dealt with, coyotes and spiders. The spiders were recluse and black widows. The coyotes, well, they were just trouble. One morning, Beth, the owner's wife, told me to get up in the hills and stop a pack that had been taking her chickens at night. In those days, there were a bounty on the critters, so I was pleased at the chance for some extra cash. I loaded up with some traps, my long gun, supplies, and off I went. I made camp along a creek in the nearby hills. It was winter, and I knew two things about coyotes. They need food and water. Chickens for food and the creek for water. That first day was all about setting up camp and fixing any broken traps. Day two was finding their trails and setting the traps. That night I heard their howls, so I knew I was in the right place. The next day I checked on my traps, and most of them had been tripped and the meat was gone. I almost expected a note from the coyote saying, "Thanks for the grub, lunkhead." I decided these guys were going to require the night hunter. I found the trail most likely used to get at the chickens, built a sort of a tree perch, and set myself up for the night. It wasn't too long before I fell asleep. That's when the growls began. I grabbed my flashlight, and sure enough, right below me was a pack of hungry dogs all looking up at me like I was some kind of dinner. I reached for my rifle and was surprised when it was gone. I flashed the light around a bit and found it right down there leaning against the tree where I had left it. I slapped my forehead and was glad that coyotes can't climb trees. It was a long and cold, dark night. I had nothing to do, so I had me a conversation with them yelps. We talked about the wrongs of eating chickens and where they could find a large burrow of rabbits. The pups arrived with their mamas, and it got to be a big old camp meeting. Except I was the preacher, and they were my flock. I must have fallen asleep again, because when I woke up, they's all gone. I went back to camp, and it came as no surprise that it was torn to pieces. Every speck of food was gone. I packed up, tucked my tail between my legs, and headed home. When the missus asked about the trip, I just said I had a long talk with them and they won't be bothering us anymore. Funny thing was, they never did. Mason Henry Blue from Dallas. Well, Mason, what a great story. And I want to thank you for sharing it with us. To Mason, I say, I think you should have told your story yourself, but I hope I did it some justice. Our second tale comes from Ron's Amazing Stories Past. Mason's story reminded me of this tale, so I dug it out of the archives, and I replay it now as I did back in episode number 186 called Universe. It aired on January 13th, 2015.
What's that you say?
I received a tweet from @whatsthat, which led to an email, which led to a phone call. I had the great pleasure to spend the next hour or so on the phone with Miss Reese. She was a wonderful gal with many great stories. I talked her into sharing one with us, and she chose to have me write and read her story. Her hope is to take her many family tales and turn them into a book. Now, I support that 100%, and so here's my contribution to the project, the Emily Reese story. I hope I do it the justice it deserves. It was the summer of 1963. My parents had left me with my Grammy for the mild months so they could take their dream trip together and tour Europe. The idea of spending the whole summer there was a thrill, to say the least. My Grammy owned a small cherry farm in Northern California. She had horses, rabbits, goats, and even a real reindeer. It would just be me and my grandmother, Ellen. Of course, she had help with the farm. There was Chuck, the foreman, and his two workers, Eli, and a man they just called Dez. The first few weeks there were just how you would imagine. I got to do pretty much anything I wanted to do, which for a 9-year-old is a lot. I did have my chores, which were actually quite fun. I fed the chickens, goats, and rabbits, and once a week had to muck out the cages and pen. But even that wasn't too bad. Grammy did all the cooking. We would have one sit-down meal per day at 6 p.m., which everyone attended. The morning meal was just us, and lunch was whatever you could find, whenever you wanted it. The farm was beautiful. It was set on a hill with a winding road leading up to the main house. A large red barn was on the east side of the hill, and it also served as the bunkhouse for Chuck, Dez, and Eli. There was a stable, general yard, and a few storage buildings scattered about. The whole thing overlooked one of the largest cherry fields in the county. It was nearly 30 acres. The farmhouse itself was very old. Grammy told me that it was built by German immigrants in the late 1880s. My grandfather bought the place in 1940. It had been completely abandoned and was in terrible shape. He rebuilt it brick by brick, stone by stone, and it took him nearly 10 years to complete. To this day, no one knows why the family left the house. All that is known is that there had been a fire, they sold out, left in the middle of the night, and never were heard from again. To To the west was a vast forest with many trails to explore. Since a little girl could get lost, I was not permitted to go too far, but even with the restrictions, I never ran out of places to explore and ride my pony, Mary. Of course, I had friends. The Jargons had a farm nearby, and they had two kids. Also, town was only 3 miles away, so I had no shortage of kids wanting to come over and stay the night. I had my own room in the top of the main house. It was the attic, really, but was my first choice to stay. The main window opened and gave you a view of the orchard below and the lights of the big city in the far-off distance. I spent many a night sitting in that window with my legs dangling outside, dreaming of the wonders only a 9-year-old could think of. I never wanted it to end. It was the day after my 10th birthday that the trouble started. That night I had a friend over, and she woke me up in the middle of the night screaming. Grammy was quick to be there, but could not comfort the frightened little girl. All she could say was that the dark man grabbed her and shook her real hard. There was no sleeping after that, and we had to take her home. When we got back, I was so frightened, I went to bed with my Grammy. The next morning was so beautiful and all was forgotten. We even got a call from our guest saying that she was fine and had no idea what had gotten into her. The next few weeks passed without incident, and I even went back to my old room. One night, I woke up and I couldn't breathe. I tried to scream, but nothing came out. I looked around the room and could see that it was on fire. Standing in the middle of the flames was a misshaped thing. I could feel the heat, the hate, and the fear. I wanted to run, but I couldn't. I wanted to scream, do anything, but all I could do was whimper. Finally, the door to the room burst open, and standing there was Eli. He ran to me, grabbed me, and the two of us got out of the room. We flew down the stairs and into the kitchen. I was sitting at the table when Grammy arrived. She heard the noise and had come to investigate. I was crying, but was able to tell her what happened. She ran upstairs and found the room completely clear. No fire, no man. Even Eli was gone. My grandmother rang the dinner bell outside the door. Within a minute, all three men were standing there. Eli swore he'd been sleeping and not been in the main house at all. Was it a dream? I don't know. It felt so real. The next morning, I moved out of that room into the one next to Grammy's. For the next few nights, we both heard strange noises coming from the attic. But soon they faded, and the rest of my summer was spent happily and peacefully. Oh, I never went into the attic again. Miss Reese told me that her grandmother lived on that farm until she passed in 1994. It was sold to a family of German immigrants. Connection? Coincidence? Who can say? I do know that I, for one, believe this story, and so would you if you'd heard Miss Reese tell it. Well, yeah, got a twofer there in that segment. If you want to hear that entire podcast, you can find it at ronsamazingstories.com. Search for the number 334 or Mason Henry Blue. And now this. It is Thanksgiving, and I'm taking a needed holiday from podcasting, editing, and watching my weight. As you listen to this, I'm probably sitting down at my sister's long oak table with other members of my family. Thanksgiving is the time to remember and say thanks to those you appreciate. Very high on that list is you, and yes, I do mean you. Each of you who listen each week make this job worth all of the effort, and if I'm being honest, I very much love doing it. I also want to thank you for your stories. It has changed the podcast dramatically for the better, and I couldn't be more happy with your response. So many good stories, so many cool things have happened to the show over the years, and I'm very proud of what we have accomplished together. We have made the show an on-air radio program with a following of about 79,000 active listeners, and that does not include those listening in their cars or home radios. There's no way to measure that. The internet side of the podcast is doing well too, with 6,000 plus listening via iTunes, Spotify, Google, iHeart, whatever service you might be using. Coming soon, we're going to be available on the mobile edition of Pandora. None of this would have been possible without you. So, thank you for listening and caring enough to send me your comments, suggestions, and your stories. Now, speaking of stories, let's get to those final chapters of Anything You Can Do, read by Mark Nelson.
It's time for this week's installment of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett. When we left Chapter 19, Bart's twin brother, Stanley Martin, is on his way to Earth, and Dr. Yoritomo tells Bart that his long-prepared-for confrontation with the Nipe will happen within days. And now, Anything You Can Do, Chapters 20, 21, and 22. The arrival of the great Stanley Martin was a three-day wonder in the public news channels. His previous exploits were recounted, with embellishments several times during the next 72 hours. The arrival itself was very carefully staged. A special ship belonging to the World Police brought him in, and he was met by four government officials in civilian clothes. The entire affair was covered live by news cameras. No one on Earth suspected that he had been on Earth for weeks before. A few knew it, but it never even occurred to the rest. Later, a special interview was arranged. Philip Quinn, a news interviewer who was noted for his deferential attitude toward those whom he had the privilege of interviewing, was chosen for the job. Stanley Martin's dynamic, forceful personality completely overshadowed Quinn. But in spite of all the publicity, not one word, not one hint about the method by which Stanley Martin intended to bring the Nipe in was released. There were all kinds of speculations, ranging from the mystically sublime to the broadly comical. One self-styled archbishop of a California nut cult declared that Martin was a saint appointed by God to exorcise the demon Nipe that had been plaguing mankind, and that the millennium was therefore due at any moment. He was, he said, sending Stanley Martin a sealed letter which contained a special exorcism prayer that would do the job very nicely. Why hadn't he used it himself? Because if anyone other than a saint or an angel used it, it would backfire on the user and destroy him. Naturally, the archbishop did not claim himself to be a saint, but he knew that Martin was because he had plainly seen the halo around the detective's head when he saw him on TV. An inventor in Palermo, Sicily, solemnly declared that he had sent Stanley Martin the plans for a device that would render him invisible to the Nipe, and therefore make the Nipe easy to conquer. No, there was no danger that the device might fall into the wrong hands and be used by human criminals, since it did not render a person invisible to human eyes, only to Nipe eyes. The first item was played up big in the newscasts. The second was quashed fast, for the very simple reason that the Nipe just might have believed it. One note throbbed in the background of every interview with responsible persons. It was the unobtrusive note of a soft clarinet played in a great symphony, all the more telling because it was never played loudly or insistently. But it was there all the same. Whenever the question of the knife's actual whereabouts came up, the note seemed to ring a trifle more clearly, but never more loudly. That single throbbing note was the impression given by everyone who was interviewed, or who expressed any views on the subject, that the knife was hiding somewhere in the Amazonian jungles of South America. It was the last place on Earth that had still not been thoroughly explored, and it seemed to be the only place that the knife could hide. Only a small handful of the vast array of people who were dispensing this carefully tailored propaganda knew what was going on. More than 99% of the newsmen involved in the affair thought they were honestly giving the news as they saw it, and none of them saw the invisible but very powerful hand of Stanley Martin shifting the news just enough to give it the bias he wanted. The comedians on the entertainment programs left the whole story alone for the most part. There were no clever skits, no farcical takeoffs on the subject of Stanley Martin and the knife. One comedian, who was playing the part of a henpecked husband, did remark, "If my wife gets any meaner, I'm going to send Stan Martin after her." But it didn't get much of a laugh, and the government organization had nothing to do with that kind of censorship. It was self-imposed. Every one of the really great comics recognized, either consciously or subconsciously, that the knife was not a subject for humor. Such jokes would have made them about as popular as the borscht circuit comedian who told a funny story about Dachau in 1946. Aside from the subtle coloring given it by the small, Mannheim-trained group of propaganda experts, the news went out straight. The detective himself, after that one single interview, vanished from sight. No one knew where he was, though. Again, there were all kinds of speculations, all of them erroneous. Actually, he was a carefully guarded and willing prisoner in a suite in one of the big hotels in Government City. On the fourth day, the big operation began without fanfare. The actual maneuvering to capture the alien that had terrorized a planet began shortly after noon. At a few minutes before three that afternoon, the man whom the world knew as Stanley Martin suddenly suffered a dizzy spell and nearly fainted. Then, almost like a child, he began to weep. Final Interlude. Colonel Walther Mannheim said, "It will take 5 years, Stanton." He was looking at the young man seated in one of the three chairs in the small, comfortable room. There was a club-like atmosphere about the room, but none of the three men were relaxed. "5 years?" said the young man. He looked at the third man. Dr. Farnsworth nodded. "More or less. More if it's a partial failure, less if it's a complete failure." "Then there is a chance of failure?" the young man asked. "There is always a chance of failure in any major surgical undertaking," Dr. Farnsworth said. "Even in the most routine cases, things can go wrong. We're only men, Mr. Stanton. We're neither magicians nor gods." "I know that, Doctor," the young man said. "Nobody's perfect, and I don't expect perfection. Can you give me an estimate on the chances?" "I can't even give you any kind of guess," said Farnsworth. He smiled rather grimly. "So far, we have had no failures. Our mortality rate is a flat zero. We have never lost a patient because we've never had one. As I told you, this will be the first time the operation has ever been performed on a human being. Or rather," he corrected himself, "I should say series of operations. This is not one single, cut-and-suture job like an appendectomy." "All right, then. Call it a series of operations," the young man said. "I assume each of them has been performed individually?" "Not exactly. Some of them have never been performed on any human being simply because they require not only special conditions, but they require that the steps leading up to them have already been performed." "You don't make things sound very rosy, Doctor." "I'm not trying to. I'm trying to give you the facts. Personally, I think we have a better than 90% chance of success. I wouldn't try it if I thought otherwise. With modern mathematical methods of analyzing medical theory, we can predict success for such an intricate series of operations. We can predict what will happen when massive doses of hormones and enzymes and such are used. But medicine still remains largely an art in spite of all that. In parallel operations performed on primates, our results were largely successful. But remember that not even every human being has the genetic structure necessary to undergo this particular treatment, and a monkey's gene structure is quite different from yours or mine. "I'll just ask you one question," the young man said firmly. "If you were being asked to undergo this treatment, would you do it?" Dr. Farnsworth didn't hesitate. "All things considered, yes, I would." "What do you mean, all things considered?" "The very fact that the knife exists, and that this is the only method of dealing with him that is even remotely possible, would certainly influence my opinion," Farnsworth said. "I might not be so quick to go through with it, frankly, if it were not for the fact that the future of the entire human race would depend upon my decision." He paused, then added, "I would hesitate to go through with it if there were no knife threat, not because I would be afraid that the operations might fail, but because of what I would be afterward." Yes. The young man caught his lower lip between his teeth and thought for a moment. "Yes, I see what you mean. Being a lone Superman in a world of ordinary people mightn't be so pleasant." Colonel Mannheim, who had been sitting silently during the discussion between the two men, said, "Look, Stanton, I know this is tough. Actually, it's a lot tougher on you than it is on your brother, because you have to make the decision. He can't. But I want you to keep it in mind that there's nothing compulsory in this. Nobody's trying to force you to do anything." There was a touch of bitterness in the young man's smile as he looked at the colonel. "No, you merely remind me of the fact and leave the rest to my sense of duty." Colonel Mannheim, recognizing the slightly altered quotation, returned his smile and gave him the next line. "Your sense of duty." The bitterness vanished and the young man's smile became a grin. "Don't put it on that footing," he quoted back in a melodramatic voice. "As I was merciful to you just now, be merciful to me. I implore you not to insist on the letter of your bond just as the cup of happiness is at my lips." "We insist on nothing," returned the colonel. "We content ourselves with pointing out your duty." Dr. Farnsworth had no notion of what the two of them were talking about, but he kept silent as he noticed the tension fading. "Well, you have appealed to my sense of duty," the young man continued, "and my duty is all too clear. I abhor your infamous calling. I shudder at the thought that I have ever been mixed up with it. But duty is before all. At any price, I will do my duty." "Bravely spoken," said the colonel. "Come, you are one of us once more." "Lead on, I follow." And the two of them broke out in laughter, while Farnsworth looked on in total incomprehension. His was not the kind of mind that could face a grim situation with a laugh. Even after he quit laughing, the smile remained on the young man's face. "All right, Colonel, you win. We'll go through with it, Martin and I." "Good," Mannheim said warmly. "Do you have the papers, Dr. Farnsworth?" "Right here," Farnsworth said, opening a briefcase that was lying on the table. He was glad to be back in the conversation again. He took out a thick sheaf of papers and spread them on the table. Then he handed the young man a pen. "You'll have to sign at the bottom of each sheet," he said. The young man picked up the papers and read through them carefully. Then he looked up at Farnsworth. "They seem to be in order. About Martin. You know what's the matter with him, I mean, aside from the radiation. Do you think he'll be able to handle his part of the job after the operations?" "I'm quite sure he will. The operations, plus the therapy we'll give him afterward, should put him in fine shape." "Well," he looked thoughtful, "5 more years, and then I'll have the twin brother that I never really had at all. Somehow, that part of it just doesn't really register, I guess." "Don't worry about it, Stanton," said Dr. Farnsworth. "We have a complex enough job ahead of us without your worrying in the bargain. We'll want your mind perfectly relaxed. You have your own ordeal to undergo." "Thanks for reminding me," the young man said, but there was a smile on his face when he said it. He looked at the release forms again. "All nice and legal, huh? Well..." He hesitated for a moment, then he took the pen and wrote, "Bartholomew Stanton," in a firm, clear hand. Chapter 21. Captain Davidson Greer sat in a chair before an array of TV screens, his gray-green eyes watchful. In the center of one of the screens, the Knipes image sat immobile, surrounded by the paraphernalia in his hidden nest. Other screens showed various sections of the long tunnel that led south from the opening in the northern end of the island. At the captain's fingertips was a bank of controls that would allow him to switch from one pickup to another if necessary, so that he could see anything anywhere in the tunnels. He hoped that wouldn't be necessary. He didn't want any of the action to take place anywhere but in the places where it was expected, but he was prepared for alterations in the plan. In the other rooms, nearly 100 other men were linked into the special controls that allowed them to operate the little rat spies that scuttled through the underground darkness, and the captain's system would allow him to see through the eyes of any one of those rats at an instant's notice. The screen which he was watching at the moment, however, was not connected with an underground pickup. It was linked with a pickup in the bottom of a basketball-sized sphere driven by a small inertial engine that held the sphere hovering in the air above the game sanctuary on the northern tip of Manhattan Island. In the screen he had an aerial view of the grassy, rocky mounds where the earth hid the shattered and partially melted ruins of long-collapsed buildings. In the center of the screen was a bird's-eye view of a man holding a rifle. He was walking slowly, picking his way carefully along the bottom of the shallow gully that had once been Upper Broadway. "Barbell," the captain said. A throat microphone picked up the words and transmitted them to the ears of the man on the screen. "Barbell, this is Barhop. There are no wild animals within sight. But remember, we can't see everything from up here, so keep your eyes open." "Right, Barhop," said a rather muffled voice in the captain's ear. "Fine. And if you do meet up with anything, shoot to kill." There were plenty of wild animals in the game sanctuary, some of them dangerous. Not all of the inhabitants of the Bronx Zoological Gardens had been killed on that day when the sun bomb fell. Being farther north, they had had better protection, and some of them, later, had wandered southward to the island. Captain Greer knew perfectly well that Stanton, bare-handed, was more than a match for a leopard or a lion, but he didn't want Stanton to tire himself fighting with an animal. The rifle would most likely never be used. It was merely another precaution. It would have been possible, and perhaps simpler, to have taken Stanton to the opening by flyer, but that would have created other complications. Traffic rules forbade flyers to go over the game sanctuary at any altitude less than 1,000 feet. One flyer, going in low, would have attracted the attention of the traffic police, and Stanley Martin wanted no attention whatever drawn to this area. Even the procedure of instructing the traffic officers to ignore one flyer would have attracted more attention than he wanted. They would have remembered those instructions afterward. Stanton walked. Captain Greer's eye caught something at the edge of the screen. It moved toward the center as the floating eye moved with Stanton. "Barbell," the captain said, "there's a deer ahead of you. Just keep moving." Stanton rounded the corner of a pile of masonry. He could see the animal now himself. The deer stared at the intruder for a few seconds, then bounded away with long, graceful leaps. "Magnificent animal!" It was Stanton's voice, very low. The remark wasn't directed toward anyone in particular. Captain Greer didn't answer. The captain lit a cigarette and leaned back in his chair, his eyes on the screens. The knife still sat, unmoving. He was apparently in one of his sleep states. The captain wasn't sure that that was the blessing that it might have seemed. He had no way of knowing how much external disturbance it would take to wake the knife, and as long as he was sitting quietly, the chances were greater that he would hear movement in the tunnel. If he were active, his senses might be more alert, but he would also be distracted by his own actions and the noises he made himself. It didn't matter, the captain decided. One way was as good as another in this case. The point was to get Stanton into an advantageous position before the knife knew he was anywhere around. He looked back at the image of Stanton, a black-clad figure in a flexible, tough, skin-tight suit. The knife would have a hard time biting through that artificial hide, but it gave Stanton as much freedom as if he had been naked. Stanton knew where he was going. He had studied maps of the area, and had been taken on a vicarious tour of the route by means of the very flying eye that was watching him now. But things looked different from the ground than from the air, and no amount of map study will familiarize a person with the terrain as completely as an actual personal survey. Stanton paused, and Captain Greer heard his voice. "Barhop, this is Barbell. Those are the cliffs up ahead, aren't they?" "That's right, Barbell. You go up that slope to your left. The opening is in that pile of rock at the base of the cliff." "They're higher than I thought," Stanton commented. Then he started walking again. The tunnel entrance he was heading for had once been a wide opening, drilled laterally into the side of the cliff, and big enough to allow easy access to the tunnels, so that passengers of those old underground trains could get to the platforms where they stopped. But the sun bomb had changed all that. The concussion had shaken loose rock at the top of the cliff, and a minor avalanche had obliterated all indications of the tunnel's existence, except for one small, narrow opening near the top of what had once been a wide hole in the face of the cliff. Stanton walked slowly toward this spot until he was finally at the base of the slope of rock created by that long-ago avalanche. "Up there?" he asked. "That's right," said Captain Greer. "I think I'll leave the rifle here, Barhop," Stanton said. "No point in carrying it up the slope." "Right. Put it in those bushes to your left. They'll conceal it, won't they?" "I think so, yeah." Stanton hid the rifle and then began making his way up the talus slope. Captain Greer flipped a switch. "Team One, he's coming in. Are those alarms deactivated?" "All okay, Barhop," said a voice. "This is Leader One. I'll meet him at the hole." "Right." Captain Greer reversed the switch again. "Are you ready, Barbell?" Stanton looked into the dark hole. It was hardly big enough to crawl through, and ended in a seeming infinity of blackness. He took the special goggles from the case at his belt and put them on. Inside the hole, he saw a single rat staring at him with beady eyes. "I'm ready to go in, Barhop," Stanton said. He got down on his hands and knees and began to crawl through the narrow tunnel. Ahead of him, the rat turned and began to lead the way. Chapter 22. The big tunnel inside the cliff was long and black, and the air was stale and thick with the stench of rodents. Stanton stood still for a minute, stretching his muscles. Crawling through that cramped little opening had not been easy. He looked around him, trying to probe the luminescent gloom that the goggles he wore brought to his eyes. The tunnel stretched out before him, on and on. Around him was the smell of viciousness and death. Ahead, "It goes on to infinity," Stanton thought, "ending at last at zero." The rat paused and looked back, waiting for him to follow. "Okay," Stanton muttered. "Let's go." The rat led him down the long tunnel, deep into the cliffside, until at last they came to a stairway that led downward into the long tunnels where the trains had once run. They came to the platform where passengers had once waited for those trains. 4 feet below the edge of the platform were the rusted tracks that had once borne those trains. He lowered himself over the edge to stand on the rail. "Barbell," said a voice in his ear. "Barhop here. Do you read?" It was the barest whisper, picked up by the antennas in his shoes from the steel rail that ran along the floor of the dark tunnel. "Read you, Barhop." "Move out, then. You've got a long stroll to go." Stanton started walking, keeping his feet near the rail, in case Greer wanted to call again. As he walked, he could feel the slight motion of the skin-tight woven suit that he wore rubbing gently against his skin. And he could hear the scratching patter of the rats. Mostly they stayed away from him, avoiding the strange being that had invaded their underground realm. But he could see them hiding in corners and scurrying along the sides of the tunnels, going about their unfathomable rodent business. 6 rat-like remote-control robots moved with him, shifting their pattern constantly as they patrolled his moving figure. Far ahead, he knew, other rat robots were stationed, watching and waiting, ready to deactivate the Knipe's detection devices at just the right moment. Behind him, another horde moved forward to turn the devices on again. It had, he knew, taken the technicians a long time to learn how to shut off those detectors without giving the alarm to the Knipe's instruments. There were nearly 100 men in on the operation, controlling the robot rats or watching the hidden cameras that spied upon the Knipe. Nearly 100. And every single one of them was safe. They were all outside the tunnel and far away. They were with Stanton only by proxy. They could not die here in this stinking hole, no matter what happened. But Stanton could. There was no help for it, no other way it could be done. Stanton had to go in person. A full-sized robot proxy might be stronger, although not faster, unless Stanton was at the controls, than the Knipe. But the Knipe would be able to tell that the thing was a robot, and he would simply destroy it with one of his weapons. A remote-control robot could never get close enough to the Knipe to do any good. "We do not know positively," Dr. Yoritomo had said, "whether he would recognize it as a robot or not. But his instruments would show the metal easily enough, and his eyes would be able to tell him that the machine was not covered with human skin. The rats are small enough so that they can be made mostly of plastic, and they are covered with real rat hides. In addition, our friend the Knipe is used to seeing them around. But a human-sized robot? Ah, no, never." So Stanton had to go in person, walking southward along the tracks through the miles of blackness that led to the nest of the Knipe. Overhead was Government City. He had looked out upon those streets only the night before, and he knew that only a short distance away there was an entirely different world. Somewhere up there his brother was waiting, after having run the gamut of publicity. He was a celebrity. "Stanley Martin, the greatest detective in the solar system," they'd called him. Fine stuff, that. Stanton wondered what the asteroids were like. What would it be like to live out in space, where a man still had plenty of space to move around in and could fashion his life to suit himself? Maybe there would be a place in the asteroids for a hopped-up Superman. Or maybe there would only be a place here, beneath the streets of Government City, for a dead Superman. "Not if I can help it," Stanton thought with a grim smile. The walking seemed to take forever in one way, but in another way Stanton didn't mind it. He had a lot to think over. Seeing his brother's image on the TV had been unnerving yesterday, but today he felt as though everything had been all right all along. His memory was still a long way from being complete, and it probably always would be, he thought. He could still scarcely recall any real memories of a boy named Martin Stanton. But, and he smiled a little at the thought, he knew more about him than his brother did, even so. It made very little difference now. That Martin Stanton was gone. In effect, he had been demolished. What little there had been of him, and a new structure had been built on the old foundation. And yet, it was highly probable that the new structure was very like that that would have been developed naturally if the accident so early in Martin Stanton's life had never occurred. Stanton kept walking. There was a timeless feeling about his march through the depths of the ground, as though every step through the blackness was exactly like every other step, and it was only the same step over and over again. He skirted a pile of rubble on his right. There had been a station here once. The street above had caved in and filled it with brick, concrete, cobblestones, and steel scrap, and then it had been sealed over when Government City was built. A part of one wall was still unbroken, though. A sign built of tile said 125th Street, he knew, although it was hard to make it out in the dim glow. He kept on walking, ignoring the rats that scampered over the rubble. A mile or so farther on, he whispered, "Barbell to Barhop, how's everything going?" "Barhop to Barbell," came the answer. "No sign of any activity from Target. So far, none of the alarms have been triggered."
"What's he doing?" Stanton whispered.
It seemed only right to keep his voice low, although he was fairly certain that his voice would not carry to the Knipe, even through these echoing tunnels. He was still miles away. "He's still sitting motionless," said Captain Greer. "Thinking, I suppose, or sleeping, it's hard to tell."
"All right, let me know if he starts moving, will you?"
"Will do." Poor unsuspecting beastie, Stanton thought. 10 long years of hard work, of feeling secure in his little nest, and within a very short time he's going to get the shock of his life. Or maybe not. There was no way of knowing what kind of shocks the Knipe had taken in the course of his life, Stanton thought. There was no way of knowing whether the Knipe was even capable of feeling anything like shock, as a matter of fact. It was odd, he thought, that he should feel a strong kinship toward both the Knipe and his brother in such similar ways. He had never met the Knipe, and his brother was only a dim picture in his old memories, but they were both very well known to him. Certainly, they were better known to him than he was to them. And yet, seeing his brother's face on the TV screen, hearing his voice, watching the way he moved about, watching the changing expressions on his face, had been a tremendously moving experience. Not until that moment, he thought, had he really known himself. Meeting him face to face would be much easier now, but it would still be a scene highly charged with emotional tension. His foot kicked something that rattled and rolled away from him. He stopped, freezing in his tracks, looking downward, trying to pierce the dully glowing gloom. The thing he had kicked was a human skull. He relaxed and began walking again. There were plenty of human bones down here. Mannheim had told him that the tunnels had been used as air raid shelters when the sun bomb had hit the island during the Holocaust. Men, women, and children by the thousands had crowded underground after the warning had come, and they had died by the thousands when the bright, hot, deadly gases had roared down the ventilators and stairwells. There were even caches of canned goods down here, some of them still perfectly sealed after all this time. The hordes of rats, wiser than they knew, had chewed at them, exposing the steel beneath the thin tin plate. And after a while, oxidation would weaken the can to the point where some lucky rat could gnaw through the rusty spot and find himself a meal. Then he would move the empty can aside and begin gnawing at the next in line. He couldn't get through the steel, but he would scratch the tin off and the cycle would begin again. Later, another rat would find that can weak enough to bite through. It kept the rats fed almost as well as an automatic machine might have. The tunnel before him was an endless monochromatic world that was both artificial and natural. Here was a neatly squared-off mosaic of ceramic tile that was obviously man-made. Over there, on a little hillock of earth, squatted a colony of fat mushrooms. In several places he had to skirt little pools of dark, stagnant water. Twice he had to climb over long heaps of crumbling rust that had once been trains of subway cars. He kept moving, one man, alone,
walking through the dark toward a superhuman monster that had terrorized Earth for a decade. A drug that would knock out the Nipe would have been very useful, but to synthesize such a drug would have required a greater knowledge of the biochemical processes of the Nipe than any human scientist had. The same applied to anesthetic gases, or electric shock, or supersonics. There was no way of determining how much would be required to knock him out or how much would be required to kill. There were no easy answers. The only answer was a man called Stanton.
"Boots, boots, 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 marching up and down again, and there's no discharge in the war."
Stanton hummed the song in his mind. It seemed that he had been walking forever through the kingdom of Hades, while around him twittered the ghosts of the dead. "Poor shades," he thought, entertaining the fancy for a brief moment, "will I be one of you in a short while?" There was no answer, though the squeaking continued. The sound of his feet and the snarling chirping of the rats were the only sounds in the world. "Barhop to barbell," said a voice suddenly, sounding very loud in his ear. "This is where you have to make your change to the other tunnel." "Barbell to barhop, I know. I've been watching the markers." "Just precaution, barbell," Captain Greer said. "How do you feel?"
"I'd like to rest for a few minutes, frankly," Stanton said.
"Feeling tired?"
There was just the barest tinge of alarm in the captain's voice. "No," Stanton said. "I just want to sit down and rest my feet for a few minutes."
There was a pause. Then the captain's voice came again.
"Okay, go ahead and relax, barbell. Take 10. But be ready to move fast if I yell. These alarm systems are tricky things to hold. And don't start moving again without letting me know."
"Right." Stanton lifted himself out of the trench in which the tunnel ran and sat on the edge of the boarding platform. It wasn't far now. There was only one more of the old entranceways between himself and the Nipe. This particular one was a transfer point, where two different parts of the tunnel network met and it was possible to transfer from one to another. It required going up a couple of flights of stairs to the next higher level and changing to another tunnel going southward. There were other ways. This tunnel, the one he had been following for so long, branched a little farther south. If he took one branch, he would end up to the east of the Nipe. The other would bring him to a point on the west. From either, he would have to travel laterally through another set of tunnels. But neither route offered anything that this one didn't have, and the most direct route would be the best.
"Barbell to barhop," he whispered. "I'm ready to go."
"It's only been 5 minutes."
"I know, but I rest pretty fast, too. Let's move out."
There were a few seconds of silence, then Captain Greer said,
"All set, barbell. Move out."
Stanton got to his feet and walked toward the stairway that led up to the next level. Minutes later, he was in another tunnel exactly similar to the first one, walking southward again. But now he was more careful. He watched the ground carefully, making sure that he didn't step on anything that would snap or rattle. The Nipe was still quite a distance away, 3/4 of a mile or so, but taking the chance that the beast couldn't hear him might be deadly dangerous. The robot rat that he was following led him along a path that had been unobtrusively cleared of rubble by the robot rats over a period of months, but the robots weren't the only rats in the place. He kept his eyes on the path. A while later, the voice in his ear said, "100 yards to go, barbell."
"I know," Stanton whispered. "He hasn't moved?"
"No. I'll yell if he does. You don't need to talk anymore. His ears might pick up even that whisper." "He hasn't moved," Stanton thought. "Not for all this time. Not since I came down into his private domain. All this time he has been sitting motionless, waiting. Wouldn't it be funny if he were dead? If his heart had stopped or something? Wouldn't that be absolutely hilarious? Wouldn't that be a big joke on everybody? Especially me."
Ahead was the large area that had been one of the major junction points of the tunnel network. This was the area that the Knipe had taken over to build his home away from home. Here were his workshops, his laboratories, his storerooms. And somewhere here was the Knipe. He came out of the tunnel into another passenger loading area. Just to his left was another short stairway that led up to a slightly higher level. He moved slowly and quietly. He didn't want to fight down here on the tracks, and he didn't want to be caught just yet. Cautiously, he lifted himself to the platform where long-gone passengers had once waited for long-gone trains. The quality of the illumination at the head of the stairs was different from that which he had been used to for the past 3 hours. He lifted off the infrared goggles. Enough light spilled over from the Knipe's lair to give him illumination to see by. Silently, he put the goggles on the floor of the platform. He wouldn't need them again. Then, step by step, he walked up the concrete stairway. At the head of the stairs, he paused to get his bearings. The illumination was not bright, but it was enough to...
"Barbell, he's heard you. Watch it!"
But Stanton had already heard the movement of the Knipe. He jerked off the communicator and threw it down the stairs behind him. He wanted no encumbrances now. He ran quickly out into the center of the big underground room, away from the open stairwell. And then, as fast as any express train that had ever moved through these subterranean ways, the Knipe came around a corner 30 feet away, his four violet eyes gleaming, his limbs rippling beneath his centipede-like body. From 15 feet away, he launched himself through the air, his outstretched hands ready to kill.
That's all for this week. Tune in again next week when I'll be joining Ron live in the Amazing Stories studio for the conclusion and wrap-up of Anything You Can Do by Randall Garrett.
There is the Thanksgiving podcast, and I hope you enjoyed it. See you next week when we play the final 24 minutes of the book Anything You Can Do, and I'm telling you, you won't want to miss the battle between Bart and the Knipe and the battle between Mark Nelson and myself. See you next week. If you want to follow the podcast or the blog, just head to Ron's Amazing Stories and you'll find everything you need. Please leave reviews and feedback about the show. It really does help us to grow. Thank you for listening, and I hope you come again to find out what are Ron's Amazing Stories.